I was curious about the context for that first reading from the prophet Habakkuk. So liturgically, the context is clear, right? The church in her wisdom selected this reading because speaking about faith, it pairs so well with what Jesus says about faith in the gospel. And so liturgically, the context is clear. But what's the historical context? Because in this reading, in the first half, the prophet is crying out to God about the unfaithfulness that surrounds him. I see nothing but violence and strife. And he's complaining, why do I cry out and you do nothing? And then in the second half, God responds. And he's talking about a vision that may seem to delay but will come to pass. He promises restoration and says, I hear you and I will answer. And he also gives a preview of something because he says, if it seems to delay, wait for it. And he says that because there will be a delay. So the prophet is writing right before the exile. So the people of Israel have not yet been carried off out of the Holy Land, but they're living in a way that means that that's coming soon. And that's what he's complaining about in the first half of the reading. He's looking around and seeing the way his fellow Israelites are living and saying, Lord, this can't last. And the reason that God warns him, if it seems to delay, wait for it, is because a delay will come. Because the other thing that the prophet sees when he's looking around is that the Babylonian Empire is on the move. And one city after another is being taken over, and they're sweeping across the region. And so he's seeing, we're being unfaithful, and they're on the rise. And these things seem to be on a collision course. And God's saying, yeah, they are. So God promises restoration, but he also lets them know that the consequences of their unfaithfulness have to play out first. Because all of God's commands are really revelations of what we're made for and what's good for us. When he says, thou shalt not lie, it's because lying actually hurts us, not because it's just some random rule he wanted to make up. And so when the Israelites are living in a way that's unfaithful to the covenant, that's like a fish that's trying to live in the Sahara Desert. It just won't work, and it has natural consequences that have to follow. They can't be skipped. And for them, the consequence is going to be the exile, being carried away from their land. And so in the midst of that, God encourages his people to persevere in faith, saying, this is going to be confusing. You're not going to see what's going on, but I need you to trust that I will restore you. To persevere in trusting him, even when they can't yet see what he's going to do and how it's all going to work out. Does any of that scenario seem familiar? To rhyme just a little bit with what we see today. I think it's really easy to look around and to want to call our society or our neighbors or ourselves faithless. To look around and see the ways that we're failing to live the faith in its entirety. And so I think often we feel like the prophet and we want to cry out, how long, O Lord? And this isn't just an outward finger pointing, it's everybody else but me thing. I think very often it's inward and personal. Because nobody knows my own sins and failings better than I do. And they're just as discouraging, if not even more, than what I see around, than what we see around us. And so it's easy to see all of that and to call it a failure of faith. But I want to propose something else, a different explanation. Because I don't believe that what we're seeing is pure faithlessness. I believe that what we're experiencing is not a failure in faith, but a failure in hope. And a failure in hope that comes from living as orphans. Faith is something that is revealed. When we have faith, it's because somebody comes and shows us something that we couldn't otherwise know, and we choose to believe it because we trust that person, not because we've seen all of the arguments and they check out to us. That's knowledge. That's something different. And so God comes. He's come through Scripture, and he's come in our own lives, and he's revealed himself to us. And we trust him. We make that act of faith. And he also comes and he reveals what we are made for. He reveals what's good for us and what's bad for us, what leads to our flourishing and what ultimately leads to our own misery. The entire moral teaching of the gospel is that revelation. It's aimed at giving us a roadmap to our own joy. It's not given just for the sake of having a bunch of rules, but because these things that are commanded are actually the things that make us happy. And the things that are forbidden are actually the things that make us miserable every time. That acting against the nature we've been given never works out for us. And so God comes and he reveals all of that to us, so we don't have to try to figure it out for ourselves. But what he reveals is very often daunting, because what we're called to is monumental. It includes everything. It includes everything from how we spend our time, to what we do with our bodies, to how we treat the people that seem the most repulsive to us. And so all of these things that are given to us as our duty, that are given to us as the roadmap to our happiness, can very often seem impossible. Because I can hear what Christ says about loving my enemies, or about the way that my sexuality is meant to be used, or about taking up my cross every day and denying myself. And I can think that, okay, that's great. That sounds really nice, but it's just not possible for me. That's too much for me. And that is hopelessness. We can try to disguise it as all sorts of things. We can call it realism. We can pretend it's pride. We can say, I know better. But ultimately, it's hopelessness. It's believing the lie that I am not capable of what God is asking of me. And the reason that we believe it, the reason that we believe that lie, is because we believe that we're alone. We believe that God will abandon us, surrounded by enemies that we're trying to love, that he's going to abandon us with more kids than we can handle, that he's going to abandon us without the comfort of all of the stuff we've accumulated. And so there is a failure in faith, but it's not a failure of faith in the moral teaching of the church, but it's a failure of faith in the Father's love for us. Because we know what Jesus asks of us, but we don't believe that God will be there to help us. But God reveals that he's given us a spirit of power and love and self-control, a spirit that was given to us at our baptism, that was strengthened at our confirmation, and that's nourished every single time that we receive communion. That's the other part that God reveals. Not just his commands, but also his promises. That at our baptism, the Father looks at us individually and eternally says what he said to Jesus at his baptism. That eternally the Father looks at us and says, you are my beloved Son, with whom I'm well pleased. You are my beloved daughter, who I am pleased with. And that he never stops saying that to us. Our Father will never leave us. And having faith, trusting what he says, is what gives us hope. That is the remedy to our hopelessness. And that's what enables us to live our calling as Christians, to do our duty. I cannot fully live the faith in its fullness by myself, because it would be too difficult and it would be hopeless. And so if I'm by myself, that is the proper response, but we're not. We're not doing it by ourselves. And so when we look at the roadmap that Jesus lays out for us, the roadmap that leads to our true happiness, we need to have faith that the Father loves us and cares for us, and that he's going to give us everything we need and more to live out these commands with joy. He's going to give us everything we need to live faithfully so that we can have joy in this life and finally at last come to the joy of heaven. To remember that our ability to do our duty, to be the unprofitable servants, isn't rooted in our own power, but is rooted in the Father's love and care for us.